My guest this morning is Michael Shermer, who I've gotten to know over the last decade or so as the lead speaker every year at James Randi Educational Foundation's amazing meeting in Las Vegas. Michael is based at Caltech in California, is the publisher of Skeptic Magazine and the author of several books, including a great new one called The Believing Brain, subtitled From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies, How We Construct Beliefs and Reinforce Them as Truths. Michael, welcome to the Big 550 KTRS.
Good morning. It's great to hear from you.
Nice to talk to you. First thing I want to talk about is a conspiracy. We just passed 9/11. And you know, because you published a terrific issue of Skeptic Magazine on this a couple of years ago, that there are still people who believe 9/11 conspiracies, even though your magazine deconstructed and debunked so many of those. What is it that makes people continue to believe that 9/11 was not done by Al-Qaeda, but was done by the USA to itself?
Right. Well, what happens is once you commit to a belief, you've decided that 9/11 was not a conspiracy of Al-Qaeda, it was a conspiracy of the Bush administration, then you just start looking for evidence to fit it, and it's easy to find because we're really good at finding evidence to fit whatever it is we believe. And it's really hard to change your mind, especially if you've created a blog or written a book or article or something like that. It's hard to take back what you said. And so you just ignore all the disconfirming evidence, and you just pick out the confirming evidence. This is called a confirmation bias. Everybody does it, but people that are like particularly politically minded or conspiratorial minded really go far out on that limb. And that's the power of belief. It's really hard to just gather new data and go, you know what, I think I was wrong, I'm going to change my mind here. That you almost never hear.
One of the things that you say in the book, The Believing Brain, is that the brain is a belief engine, that we're actually born to pretty much believe all sorts of stuff, right?
Yeah, it's very difficult to not believe something. That is, the mind abhors a vacuum of belief. We just have to form beliefs. I mean, cognitive experiments where subjects have to sit in front of a computer screen and you throw at them random dots or random noises, they will find some kind of pattern there. It's just what our brains are designed to do. So, you know, my thought experiment on this is, imagine you're a hominid on the plains of Africa 3.5 million years ago and you hear a rustle in the grass. Is it a dangerous predator or is it just the wind? Well, if it's a dangerous predator and it's just the wind, you've made a type 1 error, a false positive, but no harm. But if you assume that the rustle in the grass is just the wind and it's a dangerous predator, you're lunch. And you'll be given a Darwin Award for taking yourself out of the gene pool before reproducing. So we're the descendants of those who tended to just assume everything they hear is a dangerous predator. It's real. It's, you know, I heard it, I saw it, I read it on the internet, I heard it on the news, I saw it on a History Channel, Science Channel documentary. It must be true. So that's just the default thing, especially if it's an authority, if it's a parent figure or, you know, a person in a white lab coat or a police officer or, you know, politician, we think, oh, well, you know, must be true. And that's just what our brains do.
Well, when you're a child and your parents tell you, don't touch the stove, it's hot, it's probably a pretty good idea for a 3 or 4 year old to believe their parents, although many 3 or 4 year olds are going to test that theory themselves and find out what heat is really all about. But then as you grow and you grow into the world, you do find these authority figures. And unfortunately, we have a history, a very good recent history in the United States in the last several decades, of discovering that our leaders and politicians and others do lie to us for their own purposes. Has our disbelief function in our brain grown? Has our skepticism, if you will, grown at all?
Only formally through science. Science is by nature skepticism. The default rule of thumb in science is the opposite of what I just described. It's not believe everything. It's disbelieve everything until proven otherwise. So you have your particular theory about the cause of the common cold or whatever. We just assume it's probably not real. And if you want to get FDA approval for your new drug, you actually have to go through clinical trials. That's the reason they have those, is because most claims that are made are not true. And so despite what I described about how the brain evolved to just assume things are true, science is just the opposite because it turns out so many things are not. And the only way to tell the difference is to run some kind of experiment, gather data, you know, do some kind of big epidemiological study like they do on diseases and things like that. That's why, for example, the autism vaccination thing didn't pan out. It wasn't impossible. It might be that vaccinations have some sort of element like mercury and then that causes autism. It just didn't turn out to be true. But despite that fact, there's still a huge movement to ban vaccines and so on. It's really dangerous because there's some communities like Boulder, Colorado, who have gotten, you know, kind of dangerously close to losing their herd immunity. Once you have enough people in the herd, so to speak, in the population that are not vaccinated, then you can get the return of communicable diseases. So these ideas that take hold, they're not harmless. And that's the concern. But anecdotally, you have parents saying, hey, you know, just before my little Johnny was diagnosed with autism, we gave him his vaccines. Maybe there's a cause. Well, maybe, but maybe not. It turns out there's not. But we hold on to those beliefs because lacking another explanation for autism, which we don't have yet, we don't know the cause of autism yet, lacking that vacuum, the brain abhors a vacuum. We just can't say, well, you know what, I don't know, I'm going to wait and see. We just look desperately for something, anything to explain it.
Well, we saw another, what I think is very dangerous example of that this week when Michelle Bachmann was going after Rick Perry on Monday night at the debates about his passing a rule in Texas that all teenage girls had to get the HPV vaccine, and they got into the politics of financing his campaign and all that sort of stuff. But the next morning, she goes on the Today Show and on Fox News and on both media outlets said that a woman had come up to her in tears after the debate, and she had gotten the HPV vaccine for her daughter, and then her daughter became mentally retarded. Michelle Bachmann reports this, and no one in the media says, hold on a second, there's no connection. Mental retardation is a developmental disorder. But when Michelle Bachmann, an authority figure, says it on the Today Show or Fox News, what people will consider to be authoritative media outlets, there are probably people in America who go, well, I'm not giving my daughter that, and that is going to be dangerous, isn't it?
Yep, terrible. That's just awful. I didn't know that had happened. I mean, this is just the law of large numbers. If you have a big enough population, you're going to get little chance events like that. Remember the whole Dow Corning silicone breast implant disease claims back in the 90s where, you know, there were billions of dollars in lawsuits that were, you know, settled over that thing. It turned out there was no connection at all. It's just by chance, you know, a certain population of women had these silicone breast implants, and there was an overlap with another population of women who had these degenerative tissue diseases. And by chance, some of them are going to be in the same, you know, overlapping population. But that doesn't mean there's a causal connection there. And that's why you really need good science to tease apart those factors, see if they're related or not. And so often not, they're not related. And that's why, I mean, remember, it took quite a while to prove that smoking causes cancer. I mean, it seems obvious now in hindsight, but it did take a while to gather enough evidence. Unfortunately, the, you know, tobacco companies tried to buy off a lot of scientists and all that, and that's the political nature of science, which is unfortunate that happened.
Which we end up with things like the climate change debate and all sorts of other things, because you do have economics at risk there. You know, you got the big corporations that want to protect their own interests, and they are going to pay off some guy in a white lab coat, which you were talking about before. Hey, a guy in a white lab coat said that's not true. It must not be true. Well, wait a second. We have 999 other guys who also have white lab coats who've actually tested this and say it is true. Yeah, but one guy said it isn't. And so to many people, that's balance, and that's the belief.
That's right. Yeah. So you have a political position at right-wing scientists, left-wing scientists. You know, we should have no scientists with no wings at all. But nevertheless, so you're on the right. Your tribe says we're not supposed to believe this, so you got to desperately look around for one guy that supports your view, and then you cling to that and ignore all the rest.
Paul Harris talking with Michael Shermer, who wrote a terrific book called Why People Believe Weird Things, and now expands on that in his new book called The Believing Brain, From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies, How We Construct Beliefs and Reinforce Them as Truths. Michael, I see on your online calendar on your website that you're headed for Australia later this week for the Think Inc. conference, science and rationalism conference down under. How do other countries in the world compare to the U.S. when it comes to irrational beliefs?
Most of them are a bit lower, although they just have different kinds of beliefs. Like, you know, 9/11, truthism is not a big thing in Australia, for example, for obvious reasons.
Right.
But, you know, they have their own things down there that, you know, climate change, actually the climate skeptics are pretty big there in Australia, so I'm going to be talking about that. You know, I mean, it was reasonable a while ago to be skeptical that maybe climate change was not human caused or even happening, but, you know, the evidence is pretty overwhelming now. Last 15 years or so, there's a lot of data. I changed my mind. I was skeptical for a while, and I thought, you know what, I think it's happening, and I think we're probably the cause, and, you know, there's just so much data, and that's what you have to do. You have to change your mind. It's hard to do. You know, I don't like it any more than anybody else, but you got to do it when the facts change.
I think that's an important thing, to see what the evidence shows, and that can change your mind. When you learn more about anything, you can change your mind. You know, when you're, again, going back to when you're a little kid, if somebody asked you, how does that tree grow? I don't know. It must be magic. Well, if you actually grow up a little bit and you learn how trees actually grow there, now you can make a decision and go, well, now I understand that. Okay, fine. But the problem is that far too many people are making decisions based on no information, and they don't accept those three magical words, I don't know, as an answer, right?
That's right, yep. But on the good side, on the plus side, I think if we take the big picture, say the last 500 years, Western society is far less superstitious than it was in the Middle Ages. I mean, I like to think we've made some progress, and we're getting there. It's just that it's a long, slow haul to override all those brain beliefs that we have.
You write in the beginning of your book, speaking of changing your mind, you write about your journey to becoming a skeptic. You were actually once a believer, and you were converted to skepticism from being a born-again Christian. Can you tell us a little bit briefly about that conversion?
Yeah, well, I was young, you know, I was in high school, but I took it seriously. I became an evangelical. I went to Pepperdine University to major in theology. I went door-to-door witnessing to people. I thought, you know, if you're going to do it right. And that lasted about 7 years. I mean, I was totally into it. I wore an ichthus, a little fish, and a cross, and I read the Bible a lot. I know all the arguments. I can debate the theists and creationists because I used to make those arguments. I know what they're going to say because I believed it. And then what happened was I said I just wanted to be a college professor, and to do that you have to have a PhD, and to get a PhD in theology you have to master Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, and Latin. I could barely get through Spanish. So I had to find something I could actually do, and I was good at like math and science and statistics and research methods, and I liked that whole process of thinking, and so I switched majors to experimental psychology. And there I was really exposed to a deeper understanding of how the mind works, how beliefs are formed, you know, comparative world religions, comparative mythology, all that Joseph Campbell stuff. And, you know, it was obvious that my religion was so Western-based. Had I been born in India, I wouldn't be a Christian. You know, I'd probably be a Hindu. And doesn't that tell us something about the nature of beliefs? You know, if they're geographically bound, I mean, there's no, like, Indian physics and American physics, and they're different. It's just one physics. And so religion's different than that. It isn't something you discover because there's an actual God out there with, you know, the right answers and all that, and there's only one of them. No, there's a whole bunch of different gods and religions. And so that really brought me around to thinking, you know what, I think I've been kind of young and arrogant here to think that I had the one true God and everybody else was wrong. Maybe we're all wrong about this, and so I became an agnostic and then eventually an atheist.
And you write in The Believing Brain about that entire journey and also some of the psychology of what led you along there. Let me ask you about one other thing from the book, which is a word that, as far as I'm concerned, you invented. And the word is patternicity.
Yeah, I invented that. Yeah, the tendency to find meaningful patterns in both meaningful and meaningless noise. This is like not just the Virgin Mary on a grilled cheese sandwich or on the side of a building or, you know, Elvis on a tortilla. It's finding any kind of patterns. That's what our brains do, and we have a hard time telling the difference between the true patterns and the false patterns. Back to my hominid in the plains of Africa and the rustle in the grass. It's hard to tell. So the default rule, just believe that they're all real, but in fact not everything's real, so you got to have some systematic method to tell which patterns are real and which are not, and that's really science.
Yeah, so the baseball player who believes that the socks that he wore two games in a row that caused him to hit a home run in each of those two games, that he has to wear them for the third game because that will help him hit a home run, that's patternicity?
Yep, that's right. That's patternicity. And by the way, it's related to control of your environment and the certainty of your environment. So baseball batters will be superstitious, even though the same players when they're fielding are not, because fielders are, you know, they're successful 90-95% of the time. They hardly ever make errors. But batters, the best batters fail 7 out of 10 times. I mean, the difference between being in the Hall of Fame and being a AAA player is 1 at-bat per 10. I mean, 1 hit per 10 at-bats. It's nothing. You know, the rate of failure is so high that baseball players tend to be superstitious when it comes to batting but not fielding. So that tells us something about superstitions.
Very interesting. Well, Michael, I hope I helped you sell a couple of books here today. The book is called The Believing Brain. I know I'm not going to be any Stephen Colbert for you. Michael appeared on the Colbert Report a couple of months ago before the last time I actually saw him out in Las Vegas. And before I let you go, just for a minute, explain that experience of going on that show and what the staff of Colbert's show tell you to do as a guest.
Oh, it's really quite an experience. And first of all, they tell you, don't try to be funny. Leave that to the professionals. And they say, now, you know, he actually comes in the green room and he gives you a little debriefing. And he says, now, you know, I play an idiot on this show, right? He goes, it's just an act, but I'm not getting out of character. So I'm going to be rude. I'm going to interrupt you. Just stay focused. Stay on message. You know, just keep interrupting me and fight back and so on. And then he leaves and then they come in. And they actually brought me all the questions he might ask. Or the little funny jokes that they had written about my book. Like one of them was, it says here you used to be a born-again Christian. I just want you to know Jesus says he really misses you. and, you know, they have 12 full-time writers, comedy writers. The reason these shows are so funny is because they really do have a team of professionals writing jokes all day and bits and scripts and things like that. And they were editing all the way up to, you know, the time we started the tape at the, you know, the end of the day. So, but you see, on the finished product, it's really good because they've really worked at it all day. And even the little, just little one-liner toss-offs like that one, that's scripted. Now, not everything is scripted. You know, once he's off the page, you know, he's being spontaneous, and you can tell he really is a smart, funny guy.
And does he help you sell books?
Oh my gosh, yeah! It was the only media event I did that week. And the Nielsen ratings that tracks book sales, actual cash register book sales, show that my sales went up 342% that week thanks to that show. So thank you, Stephen Colbert.
I understand that Colbert and Jon Stewart are probably the two best book-selling places on TV now that Oprah's gone.
They are, yeah. In fact, this time I got turned down by Bill Maher's people for his show. I've been on before, but they turned us down this time, and I was really disappointed. I liked that show, but my publicist said, don't worry about it. Nobody buys books based on your show. There's no noticeable bump in sales when you do that show. So I thought, that's weird. You would think Bill Maher would appeal to a more intellectual crowd, but who knows?
Mm-mm. Maybe Friday nights people aren't thinking about what books they're going to buy.
Yeah, it could be.
Who knows? Well, maybe I helped sell a couple for you here today and with the podcast that we'll post and all the rest, because it is terrific. It's called The Believing Brain, From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies, How We Construct Beliefs and Reinforce Them as Truths. Michael Shermer, have a great time in Australia.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is the Big 550 KTRS.